talking about secular Buddhism.
Mm-hmm. You got any thoughts on the subject?
Well, I do. It's actually a theme that I've talked quite a bit about in the last year or so. And that's the Buddhism as we've received it in the West has been made into a religion, it's made into a variety of religions that are tailored to suit various cultures that are very different than our own. And two things. One is that these forms of Buddhism don't really suit modern Westerners that well because of a lot of the cultural and religious elements that they're just kind of out of sync with how we think. And how we are. The second problem with these Buddhist religions is that they have, in their popular form, they've quite seriously modified many of the original teachings of the Buddha, distorting them in such a way that, well, they suit the religious needs of the cultures that that particular Buddhist religion belongs to. But they really deviate quite majorly from what the Buddha himself taught. And that's really a much more serious problem than the first. It compounds the other problem. The Buddhism that they originally that the Buddha originally taught, I mean, he didn't really teach Buddhism, he just taught Buddha Dharma, the truth that he had realized. But the essence of that is pretty much retained in these other religions, but it's not generally available and it's not really a part of the popular forms of Buddhism. So one approach to this, well, there's been several approaches. One approach has been to try to revert to, I think in Southeast Asia, they call it core Buddhism, which goes back to what the Buddha actually said, and it ends up being a kind of fundamentalism, which isn't really very good. I think we all know the problems with fundamentalism. And that's going and trying to take the words of the Buddha as they're recorded in the sutras quite literally. And the trouble is that the sutras were heavily modified. You know, the form that we have them has been heavily modified, a lot of additions, a lot of deletions, and also because of the way the Buddha taught, it's possible to misinterpret and misrepresent those teachings. You know how it is when a fundamentalist goes to the Old Testament or to the Christian Gospels or something like that, and they take something and take it out of context and then they interpret it literally. How that can end up saying something that doesn't really seem to have anything to do with what the teaching it's a part of came from. And the Buddhist teaching is very vulnerable to that because basically if he was talking to a group of people and he wanted to lead them to understand something, he didn't dispute the beliefs that they already held. He more or less treated them as a given and then spoke in those terms to try to lead people to a deeper understanding. So the so-called core Buddhism, which is really kind of a fundamentalism, which tries to take the Buddha's teachings literally, doesn't really solve the problem. And then there's a strong secularization that's happened in North America with just taking the meditation and saying, we don't need the rest of that crap. It's just, you know, mindfulness meditation is a good thing, and we'll teach it, and we'll remove all of the religious and Buddhist connotations from it, and it becomes a therapy. Now, mindfulness is good in itself in that way. But it really is a case of throwing a baby out with the bathwater. Because what you're left with is something that's a reasonably good therapy, but not much else. Another approach has been a sort of broader secularism, and What I'm going to ask you is if this what you're seeing in Australia, where they're not throwing everything out except the mindfulness meditation, they're trying to keep as much of Buddhist doctrine as they can, but secularizing it, trying to remove all of the religious connotations from it. Is that what you're referring to?
I kept running across one person's name, is Stephen Batchelor.
Yeah.
I was just reading some of the stuff that that I found there. Mm-hmm. But as far as knowing what was happening, I haven't got a clue.
Okay. Well, actually, Stephen Batchelor is a really good example of that kind of secularization, because he spent many years, he ordained as a Tibetan Buddhist monk, and he switched and became a Korean Zen monk. And the end result of that is he became quite disillusioned. But he still sees an enormous value in Buddhism. But once again, I think Stephen has kind of thrown the baby out with the bathwater. It's sort of a different baby in a different bathwater, so to speak. Mm-hmm. He hasn't, you know, whereas John Kabat-Zinn and the mindfulness movement just says, you know, and in a sense that's what, well, I'll come back. Anyway, they just say mindfulness meditation is a powerful therapy. You know, everybody needs therapy. So Stephen Batchelor, it's similar. He tries to make use of much more of the original teachings of the Buddha. But he very much secularizes them. He say he rightly so. He takes a lot of things and says that they're metaphors. For example, one of his books is Living with the Devil, and he takes where Buddha speaks of Mara and his conversations with Mara, and his conversations with devas and things like that, and he says that these should be understood as metaphors rather than literal truths. That the flesh and blood Buddha is sitting there, and this supernatural being, this Mara, appears to him with his multitudes and with his evil daughters, seductive daughters, and or that the devas and brahmas descend from these other realms and stand before him radiating light and carrying on discussions. He says that should be understood to be metaphor, not literally true, and that Mara represents something that's within all of us, and the Buddha's conversations with Mara are really his own reflections of different parts of his own mind, sorting things out. And likewise with the devas and so forth. I agree with that. I agree with that entirely. Where Stephen Batchelor goes too far is that he seems to be saying, I mean, he seems to have lost any confidence that this, that what Buddhism is really all about, this awakening, this enlightenment, that's possible. So he seems to be taking that as a metaphor as well. And that's going too far. Because really, that is the whole point of the thing. And because Stephen, on the one hand, he's been very disappointed in his own success. And he's at the same time been very disillusioned by many of the people and many of the practices he's come in contact with. So he's just gone a little bit too far with it.
Who would you say was on the middle path?
Right now?
Yes.
I try to be. Number of people in this room that are trying to be. IMS and Spirit Rock try to be. And I don't know that they have really figured out where they stand on a lot of these issues. I'd say that they're closer to the middle path, but they restrict themselves very much to one particular kind of practice. You know, they've done an odd thing, considering that in the sutras, Vipassana refers to insight, which is the goal of all of the practice, and that he never refers to a practice called insight or mindfulness. Instead, he refers to practices that cultivate mindfulness and practices that produce insight. And in the sutras, the Buddha is talking at enormous length about samadhi and samatha and jhanas and things like that. But INS and Spirit Rock, they've done a really odd thing. They've taken a meditation method that was developed in Burma and the forest tradition in, I believe, somewhere the period 1870 to 1890. I mean, it's a very recent development, this labeling, noting practice. And they've taken that, and they say, that's what Buddhism is all about. And they kind of disregard everything else that the Buddha taught. Then there's sort of, as they say, I don't think they've quite defined where they stand on a lot of issues like karma and reincarnation and dependent arising and things like that. But I think they're much more tending towards a middle way view on that. So I'd have to say of them that their Dharma teachings are pretty close to the middle way, but their practical teachings are kind of out here in, you know, in an extreme somewhere, out in left field someplace. There is a movement, and it's something that you see in the Spirit Rock IMS, the writings of the Spirit Rock IMS teachers. You see it in the teachings of the Dzogchen fellow, Lama Surya Das. You see it in a bunch of people, that they're saying that what we have to do is we've got to understand the real significance of the Buddha's teachings, and we've got to strip away all of this stuff that really belongs to other religions and other cultures so that we can truly make it ours and come up with both practice and Dharma teachings that are appropriate for Westerners. So I see it as really, it's a strong trend. And I see Stephen Batchelor and Jack Kornfield and all these different people, they're in one way or another moving in that direction. And that's exactly what I'm doing. Same thing. I'm trying to present the essence of what the Buddha thought and what the Buddha taught. And what I want to do ultimately is to make it as easy as possible for people to distinguish between that essence and all of the other stuff for themselves. Because otherwise all I would be doing is saying, well, I have my own interpretation of Buddha and Buddha, right? And take it or leave it. If you like my version, take it up. If you don't like my version, go find somebody else whose version you like. And that's not my point. My point is to both make it clear and to also make it easier to understand. Well, first of all, to answer the question, if this is what the Buddha taught, how can we hear all this other stuff which doesn't really jive with that? And I'd like to make that understandable, because it is understandable, you know. As it becomes more understandable, it makes it really a lot easier for someone to look at what we do have to go by. And what we have to go by are the preserved teachings of the Buddha himself in the sutras. We know they've been monkeyed with, but we can look at them and we can interpret them. And we can understand a lot more clearly what the Buddha was really talking about and what he was really trying to get to. We have a lot of other sutras, the Mahayana sutras, that came hundreds and sometimes thousands of years later. But I'm quite certain, reading those, that those were created. I don't believe that, as the myth goes, that these were things that the Buddha taught in secret and they were hidden away, protected by sea serpents until Nagarjuna came along, or dictated in the middle of the night to people who wrote them down. This is what the myth says. I think that these were sutras that were written by truly enlightened individuals. And they were writing for their audiences of the time. And so the language that they used and the way they presented these, what are really extensions of the Buddha's teaching, valuable extensions of the Buddha's teaching, but once again, they're presented to a particular cultural and religious audience. And so the same way, you have to read them with that kind of understanding. And if you read them with kind of that kind of understanding, then the true wisdom that these later Buddhas were conveying, it stands out. I mean, to me, it stands out like it's written in bold print, and the rest of it's written in something much fainter, right? It leaps out from the page. And so what I would really like to do, if I live long enough, is to put this all together in a way that absolutely anybody can, to whatever degree they want and need to, can carry out the same process of discernment that I have. I don't want to be misunderstood, and this is a statement I'm about to make is one that's very easy to misunderstand and misinterpret, but the foundation for a lot of what I see in my interpretation, in other words, my ability to understand what the real message is here, comes from my own experience, comes from my own meditation experience. So that's kind of what makes it stand out from the other, and like it was written in bold text or something. Because the thing is that once you take one of these sutras and you read it understanding that, yes, this is the point that it is trying to make, this makes sense, this fits with everything else I know, this fits with my experience, then you look at what's left and you can understand why the other stuff is there. Like, if you look at all of the original sutras, they begin with, Buddha was in such and such a place, and this is who he was talking to. Right there is the clue. That always gets ignored. People skip that part, and they read what it says in the sutra, and they make something of it. But really where you need to start is, who was he talking to? Where was he? When was he? Who is his audience? Then you read it, and then all of that other stuff in there, it makes sense. If he was talking to an audience of people who believed in reincarnation, and his topic was not no self, then you can see that, okay, let's suppose that reincarnation is the way things really are. Now let's talk about this thing and see what we can discern from examining it, from exploring it. And that's what I mean about, not only does what makes sense stand out, but the context totally makes sense too. You know, you understand why he was talking in those terms. If the Buddha had talked to a devout Christian, he would have spoken from the place that the devout Christian was coming from. He could have given a sermon on Easter morning that would have been illuminating to people without ever needing to address the question of, are these sacred doctrines of Orthodox Christianity, I don't mean Eastern Orthodox, I just mean Orthodox Christianity, are they valid and have they been interpreted properly? Those questions don't need to be addressed to deliver a sermon based on the Last Supper and the betrayal and the crucifixion and the resurrection. Those can also all be used to provide a really profound teaching that would be illuminating and inspiring to people. And that's the way the Buddha taught. But of course, most Buddhists, if the Buddha were to come back and give that kind of sermon today, and most Buddhists in the world were to read that sermon, they'd be totally confused. What? Well, the Buddha believes in this, and the Buddha believes in that, right? And that's the situation we have with the suttas, with the Pali Canon, is that if you take into account who he was talking to and the point he was trying to make, and then you understand why he spoke in the terms that he did. Now, as far as a secular Buddhism goes, in a sense, that was a secular Buddhism. The Buddha had no interest in creating a religion, no interest in developing some new philosophy. And it, therefore, he was quite willing to use the beliefs and views that people had in order to say something that was really important. And so, I mean, usually we think of secular as something that has been sanitized, sterilized, has everything removed from it that is not totally worldly. But that's a different kind of secular, is where you just, you accept the predominant views of whoever you're talking about and work with them. What is not secular are Buddhist religions, because every Buddhist religion, whether it's Zen or Tibetan Buddhism or Theravadan Sri Lankan Buddhism or whatever it is, it reflects thousands of years of cultural beliefs, and it also incorporates, in every one of those instances, it incorporates a lot of religious beliefs that existed in those areas long before Buddhism ever arrived. You know, the Tibetans had the Bonpo, they had a shamanic, very powerful shamanic tradition. And you would not be able to tell the difference. If you could go back prior to, before the very first word of Buddhism reached India, and if you attended a Bonpo ceremony, chances are you couldn't really tell the difference between that and a ceremony that was conducted by the Dalai Lama or any of these Rinpoches today. Because that Bonpo shamanism was incorporated wholesale into Buddhism in Tibet. And that's the way it's always been in every situation. Of course, when Buddhism went into China, it carried with it all of the Hindu, Vedanta, accretions that it had already acquired in India. When it moved into Tibet, it not only carried those, but it also carried a lot of things from the Kashmiri Tantric tradition, which was totally non-Buddhist. So if you understand the history of these Buddhist religions, then you have a really clear picture of what you're looking at with these different situations. But there's a huge task for a Westerner, for a highly educated Westerner living in a technological, scientific society, to penetrate all of that. And it's so easy to get confused because it seems like there's so many contradictions here. But there is a key. There is a key, and what I would like to do is not secularize Buddhism, because I look and I don't see people coming to Buddhism looking for something secular. Even though the Buddha didn't intend to start a religion, people need religion, and they're going to make whatever it is that provides a foundation for their life into a religion. As has been acknowledged many times, science is one of the major religions of our culture. I'd have to add to that politics. I mean, I'm not talking so much about, you know, individual political parties, but these broader, you know, capitalism versus socialism and things like this. These are religious views. And even though they're not identified as such, you know, somebody from another planet coming here as an anthropologist to study people, I have no doubt at all that they would categorize these major political views as being religious views, and they would describe the rites and rituals that are associated with those views and the tenets that people hold and everything. So we are going to take whatever we find valuable and useful and meaningful to us, and we're going to make it into our religion. So let's start from that. Okay, if the Buddha had something really wonderful to offer, which it did, and which a lot of people are discovering, then rather than, what we've already done is we've taken these other religions wholesale, and we found ourselves quite confused and bothered by it. Some people have turned themselves into magical thinking Tibetans. Others have turned them themselves into warrior-like Zen monks. But time to move on beyond that. Let's clear. Let's start with a clean slate. And if we're going to absorb Buddhism into our culture, let's absorb it into our culture on our own terms, and not confuse and frustrate ourselves, and not have to pretend to be something that we're not. It bothers me to see people pretending to be Tibetans, pretending to hold a worldview that is natural to somebody who's grown up from childhood in a culture where magic is taken for granted. Now that's crazy for somebody that has a PhD in some Western discipline to try to make themselves into a magic-believing Tibetan. And I see people doing this, and it's like, there's something wrong with this. We can't do that.
Do you think that some of that is due to people's need to be able to label themselves as a particular belief system, or they identify with it, and they want to be able to make that statement that I'm this particular
absolutely.
Type of...
Absolutely. That is one part of it. It's a complex thing, and human nature, we like the exotic. And one of the things that makes these things attractive is their exoticness. We like to belong and identify. And so when we find something like this that we can relate to, then we want to wear the robes, and we want to have, you know, we want all of the markings that we belong. And that's completely natural. There are so many different things like that that enter into it. And we can be aware of that. Mm-hmm. And of course, that's going to create some resistance if we try to, I wouldn't say secularize, but I'd say westernize. If we try to westernize Buddhism, we're going to meet resistance, both from the other traditions and also from the people that have already, you know, the people that have already Burmese-ized themselves, or Zen-ized themselves, or Tibetan-ized themselves. Because they've already made an investment. They don't want to give up that investment.
Doesn't that have to do with the I, the self, the identity then?
Absolutely.
Whereas they're actually attaching to that identity?
If you were to introduce the Buddhist teaching into a population of stream entrants, none of these problems would be the way they are. But we're introducing them to ordinary worldlings and all of our ego needs. Our need to belong, our need to believe, our need to have leaders. That's a powerful human need. We need to have somebody that we can turn over responsibility to. You tell me what to do. You lead.
Well, so how do we get past that? I mean, even ultimately.
That is the question. I mean, that's for people like us in these kinds of situations having these discussions, that really is the question. One of the things we've got to realize is we're not going to really succeed the way we'd like to. Mm-hmm. Any more than anybody else ever has. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't do our absolute best. Right? Yeah. So how can we? Well, collectively, I think we have the wisdom to answer that question, even though the way that it manifests will be imperfect. We do have the wisdom to do that. It's something that I spend a tremendous amount of time thinking about. And there's other people that I know are thinking about it, and I interact with them, like Tim, I know. You know, Tim would like to see this teaching presented in a way that removes all references to Buddhism, and that's possible. But the question is, is that the right way? Or even if it is the right way, is it the only way? Or how do we go about doing this? You know, the word karma has already entered into the English language. It's part of Western thought. We may have a lot of strange ideas and use it in different ways, but it's already there. So, do we completely expunge the word karma from everything and expect to be able to communicate adequately as a result? I don't know the answer. I really don't. But on that, on the one hand, I see tremendous advantage in making what the Buddha meant by karma really clear to people, and maybe doing that without ever mentioning the word karma. Because it makes it easier to understand, because you don't already have these other ideas contaminating your thought. But how long will it be before you realize that, oh, this is what everybody's calling karma? You're going to figure that out at some point.
Maybe it's better if people figure it out for themselves. If they hear
yeah.
the teaching without the teacher using the word karma,
right.
And then the word karma could be introduced toward
right.
the end.
Yes.
That's
right. Now, if I found myself today in a situation where the people that I were speaking to were mostly people who had no familiarity with Buddhism or Eastern religion and philosophy, I could try doing that. You know, that could be my experiment. And for any of you, that could be your experiment. You might find yourself in that situation, in that position. And if you do, then that might be a really good way to proceed. I mean, as a matter of fact, if you found yourself addressing an audience who really knew little or cared little about Eastern religions and philosophies, I suggest that's exactly what you do. Otherwise, you're going to take a bunch of people and you're going to tell them a bunch of stuff that they're not interested in, so that you can tell them something that they will be interested in, couched in the terms that belong to another culture and another time. That doesn't make sense. But I find myself, the audience that I address, always has some familiarity and interest and attraction to these things, to varying degrees. I mean, when I'm talking to some people that have been practicing Tibetan Buddhism for 15 years, and other people who mainly gotten interested in this because of the meditation aspect, but they know it's connected to all this other stuff. So it's a huge range. But what really defines my audiences so far is that they are already oriented towards and predisposed to traditional Buddhism.
I have a sense that our audiences, what they have in their minds is their discomfort, their suffering.
Yes.
That they're coming from this place of suffering.
That's right.
And they're looking for some solution to that yeah. problem.
Exactly. Yes. That's the larger audience. That's the real
yeah.
audience. And, you know, this teaching and this practice is enormously valuable to anybody. I wouldn't hesitate to offer it to and encourage absolutely anybody who showed the slightest interest, right? But to just create another religion that another small segment of the population adheres to, the days when that was a reasonable thing to do, they're gone. If we find the means to deliver this understanding to a huge segment of society, there's a tipping point. There's going to be enough people that understand these basic principles that it's going to make a difference. If we find a way to do that, we're going to have to do that and succeed really soon, or it's going to be too late. So we don't have centuries left in which we can have a growing nucleus of people who believe in a westernized Buddhism who are going to change the course of the world. I mean, this is the Titanic, folks, and she's going at top speed in the wrong direction. She's heading for it, not just an iceberg, she's headed towards a 1,000-foot waterfall. And we can already see it. It's not that far away. So if we're going to change the direction of this boat, it's not going to be by creating another small segment of the population that adheres to a particular religious view.
I saw on the NPR radio on the internet a YouTube that they call 9-year-old Socrates. How many people have seen that?
No.
It's amazing. It's a little 9-year-old boy, and this man was a videographer, and he went to pick up his girlfriend, who was the babysitter for these kids, and the parents hadn't come home yet. So she said, well, why don't you just hang around a little bit and meet the kids? So as soon as he met this boy, he got out asked him if he could video him. And the boy was sitting outside. And he says, you know, I look at all these stars and this big thing. I don't know. I really wonder. And he says, and it's this little ant down here. This little ant must be looking around and wondering where they are and what they're doing. And the man asked him some questions, and then he'd answer, and then he'd say, but I don't know. I could be really wrong about that. But sometimes I think it's this way, and sometimes I think it's this way. And I thought, wow, the kids. I have a good faith for the future.
If they live to grow up. It's that type.
I know.
It's that type.
No, it's a mix of all the stuff. But just one point out of that is meeting people. I've been asked, why do you meditate? And I give them an answer. And they say, well, I meditate too. And, well, what do you do? And it's relaxation exercise.
Yeah. So people say, well, I garden.
Yeah. And it's not that they're gardening with mindfulness, okay? They're just gardening. And they're planting and all the stuff while they're gardening, okay?
But they find it relaxing and they like doing it, so.
Yes.
Yeah, that is the problem.
And it's not that term. I mean, there's many, many terms that people use that there's no shared meaning. Mm-hmm. Everyone has exactly. A different meaning for it.
That's a major problem. It's not the fact that we have different meanings for so many of the words that we use, almost all the words we use, is a big problem, but it's not as big as the problem that we assume that we don't. We assume mm-hmm. that we're talking about the same thing. Mm-hmm. That's the bigger problem. But I do think to do any good in the world, like I have to follow the path that I'm on that makes sense to me, which means teaching this in a Buddhist context until something changes. And if something changes and I have a different opportunity presented to me, I will adapt at that point. But in the meantime, to really make the kind of change in the world that we need, you know, I need all of you who are on different paths and will find yourself in different situations to understand what I'm saying and to be able to present it to people around you whose primary interest is something different. Now that is a really good thing that Jon Kabat-Zinn and all the mindfulness people are doing, is there are a lot of people who have no interest in this, in anything else. They go to mindfulness training for therapy, but as a result of it, they start to discover the rest of the Dharma. And that's a really good thing. So the same thing, there are people whose interest is primarily ecological or sociological or even political or whatever. If you can communicate this message to those people in their terms, and they get the core idea, they get the nut of it, then you're starting to do something that's really powerful. And I do feel like that has to happen.
And that's why I want to do that pamphlet.
Yeah.
And remove all the Buddhist references.
Right. And I realized that what I didn't give you on that thumb drive was the word version of the handout, so you can work with that. I'll send that to you. Yeah, I want you to do that. And I want you all to do that. You know, we don't need to make people into Buddhists. we need to make people understand the Buddha Dharma. And whether we call it that or not isn't important. I mean, it's nice if ultimately we can give credit where it's due. But that's not what's most important. What's most important is to communicate the deeper understanding. And now, somebody said, I think it was you, said the reason people, what people are really looking for is their...
Many of them, yeah.
The what?
Many of them.
Yeah, that they're experiencing discomfort and happiness, and they want, and doing that is exactly what the Buddha did. The Buddha wasn't teaching a religion. He wasn't converting people to Buddhism. He was teaching suffering and the end of suffering. Like, I know you got so much suffering in your life. Here, you know, I thought about it. I can tell you these things about suffering. Even better yet, I can tell you a way to overcome your suffering. No need to bring anything else into it. Although you can bring absolutely anything into it. And you can borrow from any religious tradition, philosophical tradition, anything else that helps make that person understand the truth about suffering and the end of suffering. Because that's going to be, I mean, the motivation that is causing people to do the terrible things that they're doing, both to this planet and to all the other organisms living on this planet, including other humans, what's driving them is they already want to escape suffering. I mean, all these capitalists, all these dictators, all these everybody, they're really just trying to make themselves happy and trying to avoid their own suffering. So let's meet them where they are. And if they learn, if they can learn that the shortest and most direct way to escape their own suffering is to shift their worldview away from being self-centered, that's going to save the planet. Well, it's going to save the human part of the planet. If we annihilate ourselves, Mother Nature will produce something to replace us that's probably even better. So far, you know, I think we're an improvement on the dinosaurs, and whoever replaces us will be an improvement on us. So, you know.
Well, at least they'll be different.
At least they'll be different. But, you know, when I look back at the history of the universe, I see it being as being a very progressive history. I look back at the history of human beings. I see it as being a very progressive history. So whether it's us that survive into the future and do this, or whether it's something else that replaces us, you know, it's all going to be good. It's all going to be good. But in the meantime, I'm going to entertain myself by trying to make a difference. Do the best that I can. And that's really where this brings you to. It brings you to a place where you do the absolute best you can, because that's the only thing to do. And you get over being attached to the outcome. You get over resisting what is. You just see it as something that has the potential to be better. And you, in your own joy and happiness, do your absolute best to make things better. And if this doesn't work, then you try that. And if that doesn't work, then you try something else. So, in summary, secularization is a really important thing, because all this other stuff that is dressed up in isn't necessarily helping. But I think it would be a mistake to go too far the other way and say, let's sanitize it, rename it, and go out and try to sell it. Because, well, as I said, because in my case, I'm recruiting all my salespeople from people that are already interested in Buddhism and Eastern philosophy.
Is there anyone who's written a good kind of overall history of the growth of Buddhism and its travels?
There are. Actually, I've been promising a reading list for a long time. I've been working on it. And there are some Western scholars who who have done some really good work in that. And like Rupert Gethin is one. And I'm rereading a book of his that I read many years ago. And I'm realizing how much I had learned from that many years ago, and I didn't even remember where it came from, but it's definitely going to be on the list.
So we need to keep reminding you?
Keep reminding me.
To do the reading list?
Right. But this book, I can recommend this book to you immediately. Of course, I can't remember the name of it, or I tell you the name of it right now.
Rupert Gethin?
Gethin, G-E-T-H-I-N. Okay. Rupert Gethin. And I'm not sure what the name of the book. It might be something like The Basics of Buddhism or The History of Buddhism. No, it wouldn't be The Basic. It's sort of an overview. It covers the Theravada and the Mahayana and stuff like that. And there are other books that do that very well, too. Interesting, the history of Buddhism is a wonderful study in human nature. You know, and that's one of the ways that I see it right now, is to see how Buddhism has evolved in all these different directions. In every case, as an expression of human needs, human nature, human cultural processes. You know, the need, a belief system like Buddhism, in order to spread and propagate, needs support from very powerful secular support, which almost always came in the form of kings and emperors, right? Although it also came from very wealthy people. You know. So, I think that's going to have to happen in our society as well. We're short on kings and emperors these days, and that's fine with me. I don't want to see that change. And I do believe that there should, you know, church and state should be kept completely separate. But the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution of the United States incorporate some really powerful, forward-looking, humanistic ideas. And they really did grow out of European Christianity and the Renaissance, the Enlightenment. And they have become part of a political configuration that bears no obvious connection to those roots. I mean, although more recently people have stuck the words in God into the Pledge of Allegiance and stuff like that. But it's really remarkable to have a political system that is not religious but is a reflection of values that came historically from religion. And see, if you could picture a modern political structure starting to incorporate these Buddhist values, now that would be really powerful. And that structure would have the means to educate people from children from a very young age in ways that could seriously transform the entire society in a short period.
Well, that seems to be one of the major values of Christianity and Buddhism. Both are the precepts and teaching people how to behave to make a society better, and also to make themselves feel good. I think people really want to feel good.
Yeah. Well, and that's the fundamental basis of religion as religion. Religion is a cultural and social institution that exists for the purpose of making people manageable and governable, and making people feel better about the nasty side of the human condition. That's religion's purpose. I mean, you can take any religion and you can interpret it in these terms. Okay, this has been structured, it operates for these two purposes: to make people behave and to make people feel a little bit better about the rotten situation they're in. That defines religion.
And that brings a kind of happiness.
It brings a kind of happiness, right.
A kind of happiness.
But we need to go way beyond that.
Well, I understand that. But it's a part that sometimes gets thrown away if you're going to throw away the, as you said, the baby with the bathwater.
Right.
Because that's part of it that
that's
would
right.
be thrown away. Then you could say, well, it doesn't matter how I behave now. It's take care of myself and go back. Because it does cause people, I think, to think more about each other and to be kinder to each other and things like that. But if they get very disillusioned or they feel like, well, I don't want any of it, I don't believe in any of it, then go the other way.
Yeah, and then they get
unhappy.
What you end up with is that's radical anarchism, which is what successful capitalists are, radical anarchists.
Mm-hmm.
And serial killers are radical anarchists. there's a lot to think about. It's like religion is generally presented, morality, as something that is laid down by a higher power. But the reason religions have morality is partly to make people behave. And the secular religion in the West has done that. What is secularized morality? Anybody tell me the answer? Well, we have a word for it. It's a six-letter word for secularized morality.
Ethics.
Ethics. Ethics. The whole theory of ethics is we should behave because it's ultimately in our own self-interest to behave. That's ethics for you. If we all follow these rules, we'll all be better off. And therefore, we should punish anybody that doesn't follow these rules.
Because it
will be to the benefit of the larger number of people to punish the small number of people who don't follow the rules.
But it doesn't say anything about love.
No, it doesn't. It is a pure... Neither does morality. I don't see love anywhere in the Ten Commandments. It says honor your mother and father. It doesn't say love them.
I don't want to love my toaster maker. That's all I want to know, is that they ethically made a good toaster.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. So if we get into the discussion of love, now we've moved outside of both morality and ethics. We've moved into another dimension.
That's one I'm interested in.
We'll start that one when we have about 3 hours.
Well, but I could just say this much, that in all of our blind scrabbling, that is the positive motivational force behind it, is love, really. It might take 3 hours to make a case for that, but that really is what's behind all of it, no matter how misguided it is.
How misguided what is?
The behaviors that we manifest in the world.
Well, but isn't love and aren't love and self-interest kind of antithetical to one another?
Well, in an ultimate sense they are, but as we know, there's pure love, there's this agape, and then there's this selfish erotic love. And we use the same word for those because we realize that they actually exist on a spectrum. You know, self-love becomes love for somebody that you extend the boundary of self to include. Self-love becomes love of family. Self-love becomes love of country and patriotism. So in the ultimate sense, and understanding love in a purer sense, it's totally antithetical to selfishness. But on the other hand, love manifests through an extended self.
But if the objective is to transcend the self, so that love is not about self-interest, mm-hmm. love is about the interest of the whole.
Yes, that's right. That's where we want to go. We have to start where we are.
Yeah.
We pull ourselves up by our own bootstraps, so we start with where we are. And, you know, it is a positive step to expand the boundary of the self. And we should do that. But, of course, we see that by itself, you know, we love our own clan or tribe, and we're willing to destroy the other clans and tribes in order to benefit of it. It's got that. The self part of the picture has this downside that somehow coexists with the love.
Well, is love the wrong word to use, or inaccurate word? I mean, isn't, like the Buddha talked about loving kindness, metta, and compassion. Did he really ever talk about love? I mean, they're different.
Well, we translate metta as loving kindness because we're trying to capture that difference. That because, you know, I love chocolate cheesecake and I love sexy women.
That's
and
attachment.
Right? So it's to
exactly.
Yeah, it's to capture that difference.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. Loving kindness. And the Greeks called it agape. And if we look at the feelings that parents have for children, it's an interesting combination of that. We have a love for them that's of the kind that we'd be willing to sacrifice ourselves for. But at the same time, we have this very selfish love. We want them to be in a particular way. You know, they're an extension of our ego.
So the key would be to get past that, actually.
The key is to get past that. So we start where we are.
Yeah.
And we understand the difference, and then we work on the difference.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So we've gone from secular Buddhism to love. That's a good journey. I think maybe it's time to end this discussion and have a little break, and we'll come back and sit.